Today on The Novelizers, from Geek and Sundry, Felicia Day. From Bonanzas for Bonanza, Andy Daly. And intern Kevin Carter. Now here's your host, Andy Richter.
Hi, I'm Andy Richter. When I was in sixth grade, my teacher, Mrs. Norris, took my whole class to the tuna fish canning plant over in Midland. I looked on as huge vats of processed tuna putty were molded into shape, inserted into cans, and loaded onto flatbeds to be shipped to hungry families all over the world. It got me thinking, what if I could take the same principles they used for fish meat and apply them to great literature? That's what this podcast is all about. We catch classic movies, then process them by getting tons of writers to take a shift, converting each scene into a bite-sized chapter. Next, we move those chapters down the conveyor belt where actors are waiting to narrate each one. Finally, I send them off to hungry minds via this podcast. We call our operation The Novelizers. This season on the podcast, we're novelizing the classic film Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And here to catch us up on the story so far is my intern, Kevin. Kevin, what's happening to our friends Kirk, Spock, and the other guy?
Sure, Andy. So there was this big space battle, and the Enterprise, captained by a Vulcan named Savik, played by Kirstie Alley, got blown up. But it turns out it was just a simulated space test called the Kobayashi Maru. Then it's Kirk's birthday, and Dr. Bones McCoy gives him some space whiskey and reading glasses and tells him his life is boring and he needs to go.
Thanks, Kev. Do you prefer to be called Kev or intern?
Kev is fine.
Great. Our next chapter was novelized by David Goodman, writer for Futurama, Family Guy, and The Orville, and narrated by Felicia Day, who you know and love from Supernatural, The Magicians, MST3K, and more. Felicia Day, engage.
Chapter 3, Preanimate Bullshit, novelized by David A. Goodman, narrated by Felicia Day.
Okay. Starship log, stardate 81304. Log entry by First Officer Pavel Chekhov. Starship reliant on orbital approach to SETI Alpha 6 in connection with Project Genesis. We are continuing our search for a lifeless planet to satisfy the requirements of a test site for the Genesis experiment. So far, no success. On the bridge of the Reliant, Chekhov stared at the view screen and thought, was that a good log entry? He really didn't care. He knew the captain made him record the log when there was nothing to say. They hadn't even looked at SETI Alpha 6. They really should record the log after they examine the planet. Of course, later, Chekhov would admonish himself that he was so annoyed at having to record the log, he didn't notice that there was a planet missing in the SETI Alpha system. If he'd noticed, that might have saved a few headaches. And deaths. Chekhov looked around the bridge. It was smaller than the Enterprise's and kind of dirty. There wasn't actual dirt. It just looked unclean. Maybe it was because so many of the officers were old men. Chekhov hated it. The whole fucking ship was a symbol of a stalled career.
Standard orbit,
Captain Tyrell said. Chekhov watched him as he slowly got up from his chair. Oh, this guy. When Chekhov met him over subspace 6 months before, he somehow assumed that Tyrell was ready for retirement. Take this first officer job, Chekhov thought, and in a couple of years, Tyrell will step down and the ship would be his. But then Chekhov reported for duty, and on his first day there was a birthday celebration for the captain. It was Tyrell's 43rd birthday. Chekhov was 44. The captain was younger than him, but it was too late. Chekhov had already taken the job. He was screwed. And he blamed Tyrell for screwing him, even though it wasn't Tyrell's fault. He tried to take comfort in the fact that he was better off than Sulu and Uhura, who were still in the same jobs they'd been in for 20 years.
Mr. Beach, any change in the surface skin? Tyrell asked the science officer.
Negative, Beach said. The planet's incapable of supporting life. Later, Chekhov would effectively blame Beach for not noticing there was a planet missing in the SETI Alpha system. Beach was the science officer. It was his job to notice the missing planet. As stalled as his career was, they were not going to hang this mess around his neck.
Does it have to be completely lifeless? Chekhov asked the captain.
He really didn't want to tell the captain about the minor energy flux reading in the dino scanner because that meant they'd have to move on, and this mission was boring as shit. But he had no choice.
Don't tell me you found something, Tyrell said.
We picked up a minor energy flux reading on one dino scanner. Tyrell was annoyed, and Chekov didn't blame him. Who knows how long it would take to find another lifeless planet? This mission could go on for another year. Maybe the scanner's in need of adjustment, Tyrell said. I suppose it could be a piece of pre-animate matter caught in the Matrix, Chekov said. Well, that was total bullshit. When had a piece of pre-animate matter ever gotten caught in the Matrix? The technical manual for the dino scanner said you had to be careful about pre-animate matter getting caught in the Matrix, but Chekov had never seen it happen. God, he was so tired of this crap. Chekov was then slightly taken aback that this paper-thin excuse was enough for Tyrell. Get on the comm link to Dr. Marcus, Tyrell said to the communications officer, Commander Kyle. Yes, sir, Kyle said. That guy used to run the transporter on the Enterprise, and now he's here answering the phone. That's a crappy career. But then Chekov started to wonder how old Kyle was. He was older than Chekov, had to be, right? He could look it up, but he didn't want to, because if that guy turned out to be younger, oof. No, he definitely had to be older. Maybe it's something we could transplant, Tyrell said. It was clear to Chekov that Tyrell wanted out of this turkey of a mission just as bad as Chekov did, but this was a really stupid idea. What, they were going to find some life down there and move it to another planet? Oh yeah, Dr. Marcus was really going to go for that. Some piece of life that came out of that crappy biosphere and she was going to tell us to move it to another crappy biosphere? What an idiot, Captain, Chekov thought. You know what she will say, Chekov said wearily. I'm on a ship of losers, Chekov thought. And I'm one of them. Let me get this straight. Something you can transplant? Carol Marcus said. She was in the main laboratory of the Regula 1 Scientific Research Laboratory. The other scientists in the lab on the upper and lower levels around her acted like they were still at work, but she knew they were all listening. They'd all been living there for almost a year in orbit around Regula 1, tired of looking at the same six people every day. They wanted to go home, but their fate was in the hands of these two Starfleet bozos on the other side of her comm screen. How hard is it to find a lifeless planet? She could tell that the once enthusiastic Starfleet men had lost all interest in the mission. They just wanted to be done. Were they really suggesting that they go down to the planet and find whatever life form they find there that grew up on that planet and then take them to another planet and it would be just fine? They thought that was okay? Didn't that violate their prime directive or something? But Doctor, it may only be a piece of pre-animate matter, Captain Tyrell said. Then again, it may not. Carol couldn't believe this guy. A particle of pre-animate matter caught in the Matrix? When had that ever happened? She'd never seen it. You boys have to be clear on this. There can't be so much as a microbe or the show's off. They stood there looking at her. She laid down the law and they just stared. Now she felt bad. It was only a second, but it felt like forever. And she caved. Oh, well, why don't you have a look? But if it is something that can be moved... You bet, Doctor. We're on our way, Tyrell said, and the picture cut out. She'd fallen right into their trap. They just needed her permission, and they could go ahead with their cockamamie transplant idea. She was so desperate to get off the station, she began to hope that maybe it would work. She looked at the chronometer. 18:30, dinner time. She started shutting down her station and got up to leave, thinking about a nice bath and maybe a half a bottle of wine. Or a whole bottle. Then her son David walked over to join her. Why are we wasting time looking for a planet anyway? David said. We could probably just drop the thing inside a nebula and it would make a planet. Oh, yeah, and if that doesn't work, Carol said, what happens then? I'll have to go find some old boyfriend to take me in. They exited the main laboratory, heading out into the corridor. We don't have kittens. Genesis will work. They'll remember you in one breath with Newton, Einstein, Surak. Thanks a lot, Carol said. No respect for my offspring. They stopped at the intersection. To the left was Carol's quarters, where her bath and bottle of Chateau Picard waited. Teaming up with me for bridge after dinner? David said. Maybe. Carol said. Oh, crap. She could tell something was on his mind. No quiet bottle of wine tonight. She was going to have to keep her son company. What's wrong? She said. Not really wanting to hear the answer. She loved her son. She loved that she got to work with him. He was a genius, but sometimes he was just so goddamn needy. Every time we have dealings with Starfleet, I get nervous, David said. We are dealing with something that could be perverted into a dreadful weapon. God, he was so overdramatic. He didn't get that from her. Probably from his father. Remember that overgrown Boy Scout you used to hang around with? He's exactly the kind of guy we should be worried about getting his hands on this. Carol wondered sometimes if it had been a mistake to lie to David and tell him she'd been artificially inseminated. He was probably old enough to know the truth, but she really didn't want to tell him. Just the thought of Kirk got her reminiscing. Like right now, the night they'd conceived David, in the men's room at the 602 Club in San Francisco, up against the wall, dirty, smelly, so hot. Listen, kiddo, Jim Kirk was many things, but he was never a Boy Scout. As she walked away, she decided to hell with cards. She was going to have that wine, and then maybe see if she could dig up some Klingon porn.
Thanks, Felicia. Now that's the kind of writing that's too good for any book. Now let's turn things over to my intern, Cab, for a behind-the-scenes interview with some of the folks who made the film Wrath of Khan a reality. Kevin, take it away.
Hello, I'm Andy's intern, Kevin Carter, and I'm your host for the interview portion of The Novelizers. Today, I'm here with Arthur Meyer, who had the wonderful job of being William Shatner's body double. Arthur, how's it going today?
It's going pretty good. Yeah, I saw my uncle 3 weeks ago, so I'm feeling really good.
Oh, let's get right into it. Is William Shatner your uncle?
My uncle is this guy named Larry, but William Shatner, I was his body double in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, but it's just my uncle's a great guy, so whenever I see him, it's like I'm set for a couple months, you know?
What was your first ever body double experience that you can share with us?
Well, let's see. I was in the movie Caligula. It's basically about a bunch of sex happening, but it takes place like years ago. Like I want to say like the 1950s or something.
Okay. Gotcha.
In like Rome or Egypt. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's basically a lot of orgies. Mm-hmm. And there were some actors in that movie who didn't want to have intercourse. So I volunteered because I've always liked sex. It makes me feel good for me in my penis region. And then if I keep having sex, then a lot of times I get to a point where I have what's called an orgasm. And that just is the best feeling ever. And I got to do that in Caligula.
I don't know why I thought, but when you said the best time to have, when you're about to have a, instead of you saying orgasm, I thought you were going to say have a Caligula, because I don't know what that word means, but I thought it was another word for orgasm. But yeah,
Caligula, I think, is just one of the female body parts.
When you was able to do that role, was that something that really sparked your interest and said, you know what, I want to continue to do this? Not the sex part, because I'm assuming...
Oh, okay. I was going to say, because it definitely made me want to have more sex.
Exactly. Yeah. You would definitely want to do that. I mean the idea of being a body double in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing it made me want to do was, have more sex. But then I was like, so yeah, when you're done having sex, usually it doesn't feel as good as when you're having sex. You know, in those moments when I'd be done having sex, I'd be like, well, I got to get work, you know, I have a couple kids and stuff. Yeah, that's kind of like what led me into non-sexual body doubling.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there's lots of movies that they make that don't even have any sex in them.
What got you into being a body double? Like, 'cause that seems like a weird job to get into. So what got you into that?
I do love acting. I've always been passionate about it. I wanted to pursue it professionally, but then it turns out that I guess it always helps if you've like been in stuff in order to get a part. But my question is like, how do you even get into something if you've never been in something, you know? True. Anyway, true. It turns out that even if you haven't been in anything, but you have a body that like kind of looks like someone else's body, you can do acting that way. It's essentially acting, but harder than regular acting.
What makes it harder than regular acting?
Well, you know, you really have to mimic the person who you're like body doubling. I don't know what you call that person. I guess you call them the main actor, but you have to be looking closely and seeing how does this person drink tea? How does this person tie their shoes? Do they wear Velcro shoes? And if so, how do they Velcro their shoes? And in the case of a movie like Star Trek II, it's, you know, like I got to really try to work closely with William Shatner. I never got the chance to meet him, but I tried working really closely with him.
So that's interesting. You never met William Shatner. So what tools did you use to really mimic the tea drinking and
binoculars? Binoculars was the main tool that I used because they had this rule on set where they would make me stay far away from Bill. I had to sit, you know, not that far away, 50 yards away, but they let me use binoculars.
Can you walk us through when you got that call, like what it was like to receive that call knowing that you were going to be on this huge debut movie?
Oh, it was amazing. I called my mom and we hadn't spoken in years. So that call didn't go well. But then I called my dad and that did go well. And he was a big Bill Shatner fan. And by the way, like I have worked with Bill. So I call William Shatner Bill, but other people who haven't worked with him can call him William.
Does he go by Bill, or you just something you decide to call him?
He does by people who know him.
Okay.
And I feel like I know him because my body was basically the same size and shape as his.
Gotcha.
But I even forgot your question.
What was it like when you received that call? Like, to walk us through that moment.
Oh yeah. So I called my dad and I was like, Dad, guess like the craziest thing happened. Guess whose body I'm going to body double for. And he guessed Charles Nelson Reilly. And I said, no. And I said, guess again. And he said, Richard Dreyfuss. And I said, no, guess again. And he said, John Belushi. And I said, no, guess again. It went on for a while, but eventually I told him, this is for William Shatner. I called him William then because I didn't know him as well. Mm-hmm. And my dad absolutely went crazy. He's loved Shatner ever since his Star Trek days.
So I know you never really met him, but was there any stories or something you could tell us about the film that maybe something happened behind the scenes or something that let us know how it was on set?
There's that scene in the movie early on where like it's his birthday. This is so weird, but my birthday, like the day that they shot that scene, my birthday was coming up in like 3 or 4 weeks. So I just remember telling that to the director on set. He was great, Nick. His name is Nick Meyer. Mm-hmm. He's not related to me, but we have the same last name, which I looked it up and I guess that happens sometimes. And I said, hey, you know how it's Captain James's birthday? Well, it's my birthday coming up in a few weeks. And isn't that funny? And he nodded his head.
Did he nod it up and down or left and right?
Wait, which one is nodding? Nodding is left and right. Yeah. Okay. So he nodded his head left and right and said, no. He just said no. I didn't know what he meant by that. There was another cool thing about body doubles is, you know, you get to become friends with all the other actors' body doubles. So, you know, there's a body double for Nimoy. There's a body double for Christy Alley. There's a body double for Joe Takei. And, you know.
So everybody has a body double.
Everybody. Even the director has a body double. The security, because it's a big Hollywood movie and, you know, they need to make sure everyone is accounted for. So there's a body double for like, the interns and, you know, like the scrubs, like getting the coffee and stuff.
Have you ever lost yourself in your craft? Like, have you ever just went into a deep pit of despair and disgusting thinking and living because you couldn't stop yourself from being like somebody else?
Yeah, so I have lost myself, but it was when I got lost and couldn't find where the lot was. So there's this restaurant that existed back then called Beefsteak Charlie's, and they bought everyone on set that day Beefsteak Charlie's. Mm-hmm. And I was like so excited, but you know, they make all the actors and directors and stuff eat first. And by the time they were done, like I was at the back of the line, I was getting so angry. And I was like, why is this taking forever? And I'm like, I could drive to Beefsteak Charlie's and pick up something faster. And so I did that. But back then we didn't have iPhones, which have maps that tell you directions and stuff. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we shot this thing in Los Angeles. Next thing you know, I'm in Kansas. And wow. I held up shooting for a couple of days, you know, but, you know, they're a big time studio. So they flew me back and I didn't even have to reimburse them the whole thing. So, but I did lose myself in that sense of the word lose.
But listen, I want to thank you and the listeners want to thank you for joining us today to shed a little light on your profession.
Well, thank you so much. This was really a lot of fun and it makes me feel really special to be asked a bunch of questions.
Not a problem. I want to thank you for listening to this interview portion of The Novelizers. I have been Kevin Carter, and please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Oh, are we back on? Oh, well, that was great, Kevin. Fascinating stuff. Our next chapter was written by Andrew Lynn and narrated by Andy Daly from Comedy Central's Review and Eastbound and Down on Max, way back in the day when Max was still called HBO. Andy Daly, make it so.
Chapter 4. It turns out it's SETI Alpha 5, not SETI Alpha 6. Novelized by Andrew Lynn, narrated by Andy Daly. "Captain Terrell, stand by to beam down," said Mason Dirth Mordor, moments before he pulled the lever that made Terrell and Chekov beam down. A few moments later, the two space explorers were down on the surface of the planet, while the spaceship that they had been aboard only moments before continued to float like a moon above them. This was thanks to a kind of teleportation technology. Chekov didn't understand it. Understanding things just meant more work. "We have beamed down," said Captain Terrell over the comlink. "Roger that," said Mason Dirth Mordor. "Let me know when you want to beam back up. I'll be right here." "Thanks, Mason," said Terrell. "Awesome work, too. Smooth." "Just doing my job, Clark." The conversation stopped there, but both of them could tell that the other one was smiling. Chekov wasn't smiling. He was frowning, deeply, as he looked around the planet for a direction that didn't suck. "Chekov, you sure these are the correct coordinates?" Terrell looked over, his tone both jovial and critical, the way you talk to a baby trying to eat a hot dog from the middle outwards. What a dick. Like it was Chekov's job to keep track of this stuff. That was Mason Dirth Mordor's job. But everyone loved that guy. Nobody liked Chekov. That was the one thing Chekov and everybody could agree on. The ship's janitor could run up behind him and yank his pants down in front of the king of Starfleet, and everyone from His Majesty down would only think it was hilarious. Chekov safely rolled his eyes, knowing that Terrell couldn't see into his enormous space helmet. "Captain, this is the garden spot of SETI Alpha 6. Good one, he thought to himself, because this wasn't a garden spot. Far from it. He was being sarcastic. Everything was lost in an orange fog of blowing sand except for the occasional rock formation. That was it. The most interesting thing you could say about the planet was that it had almost the same name as the planet where Captain Kirk had stranded a guy named Khan. But that planet was called SETI Alpha 5. This planet was called SETI Alpha 6. Completely different planet. Chekov smiled to himself, knowing that there was no way he was going to run into Khan during this mission. There was a deafening whooshing of wind, beneath which could barely be heard the beep of a tricorder. Beep, 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 over and over again. Everybody hated that beep. Once you noticed it, you couldn't really tune it out. Maybe you forget it was there for a while, but then you'd notice it again, and somehow that was actually worse. If it found something, it would stop beeping. Exactly the opposite of the way you'd think it should work. The noise couldn't be turned off unless you popped out the batteries, and you couldn't do that here because of all this sand blowing around. It would get inside and ruin the device. Chekov bitched about the tricorders constantly, which is one of the reasons nobody liked him. It was almost as annoying as the beeping itself. Just another thing you had to put up with when you were in Starfleet. The tricorders would also break constantly. They were built from cheap plastic you could bend with your finger. Sometimes you'd drop one or it would fall off a table, and when you picked it back up, you would hear something rattling around inside, like maybe a screw that had come loose or a little chip of the cheap plastic. Yet it would still seem to be working perfectly fine. Was it broken or not? Was it rattling like that before you dropped it? Why was there even an extra screw there in the first place? Maybe it was about to break for real, and if Chekov could return it to the equipment manager quick enough, it would be the next person's problem, and nobody would know it was actually Chekov's fault. Not likely. The equipment manager was the beloved asshole Stryker Bossmaster. Everyone always took that guy's side. Was it in spite of the fact that he was a big jerk? No, they loved him because he was a jerk. Everyone loves a jerk as long as they aren't the one the jerk is being a dick to. That was Chekov. It was always Chekov. He was lost in these thoughts when Terrell shouted at him, "Chekov, over here!" Great. Now Terrell was pissed off. "He totally hates me," muttered Chekov. "Everybody hates me." Terrell was standing on the edge of a short ridge of rock, looking out over what should have been more of the same. Chekov went over to see what the big deal was. Terrell turned to him. "Those look like cargo carriers." "Cargo carriers?" That was completely bonkers. Chekov looked over. Nestled into a shallow valley was a little group of Starfleet cargo carriers. Good ones, too. Not the kind that Starfleet would just leave in any old place like glorified trash cans. How did they get here? Why would SETI Alpha 6 have cargo carriers on it? But there they were, big rectangular boxes made from corrugated zaxthoratic steel. That was strong stuff. A Clamptarian Cramstodoto couldn't punch a hole in those things with either butt antler. Nor could a Trimstrothic Drogtoron envelop and digest it with its pre-fisted trianus. In fact, it would even be near impossible for a Stoichacid on Shellos Dorgoff to penetrate them with its cavernous superatomic hard-on. The more Chekhov thought about it, the more it became clear that even a juvenile Braptixerdy Fusk Torpon with a fully intact penile murder flap would almost certainly fail to plant a single one of its donk-pastic hemorrhoidal pseudo-fetuses inside one of them. Starfleet cargo carriers were strong stuff. Fortunately, one of them had a door on the side. Whew! Chekhov and Terrell made their way down and contemplated the door. It appeared to be unlocked. "Hey, give me a hand," said Terrell. With the sum total of their strength, they managed to open it and go in. Their helmets immediately began to fog up with what was clearly normal air, so they removed them and looked around with sweaty heads. People had been using these carriers as living quarters. There was crap strewn all over the place. Unmade bunks, a half-played game of checkers, and a lasagna were three of the things they could see. Looking closer, you could tell that the checkers were actually rusty gears and little stones, which Chekhov thought was a cute touch. There was something that looked like a jetpack stuck to the wall. It probably wasn't, but Chekhov was still impressed. "What the hell happened here?" said Terrell. "If they crashed, then where's the rest of the ship?" It was a good question that would never be answered. It didn't matter. Chekhov wasn't listening. He had found something odd on the other side of the room. Terrell came over to see. It was a clear glass tank full of sand. Something inside was making the entire thing jiggle around like a cheap prop. Terrell, with genuine interest, got into a crouch for a closer look. Something was moving under the dirt. Chekhov was pleased that he had been the first one to find something cool, but was already bored, so he wandered over to the other side of the room. "What the hell is that?" he said. It was a bookshelf. So maybe he shouldn't have sounded so surprised. There were a bunch of books on it. Dante's Inferno, Melville's Moby Dick, and the Holy Bible by the ancient land wizard Jesus Christ. There were more of them, all the same kind of really old book that nobody reads for fun. Nothing exciting there. Thinking quick, Chekhov looked around for something else to pretend to have found so interesting. Above the books dangled a nylon strap fastened by a steel buckle with SS Botany Bay printed on it in all caps. Something stirred in Chekhov's mind. Maybe this actually was an interesting find. "Botany Bay," he said out loud, but by then he had already figured it out. His eyes bulged out of his face, making space for all the scary thoughts that were filling his mind. "Oh no!" he spun around and booked it over to Terrell. "We've got to get out of here now, damn!" Terrell was still looking at the thing in the sand tank. "What about the tricorder?" he said. The tricorder had stopped beeping, its stupid way to let you know it had found something. Terrell reached down and grabbed it off his belt. He was too focused on what it wanted to tell him to notice the sound of something rattling around inside it. A little screw, maybe. Chekhov shouted with the impatience of raw fear. "Hurry! Never mind that! Hurry! Hurry!" "Chekhov, what's the matter with you? Chekhov!" Of course it was Chekhov's fault that something was the matter, like he would ever have a good reason to say anything at all. Terrell got up and went after him. "Come on, hurry!" Chekhov yelled again, the last word muffled by his helmet as he slammed it down over his head. Terrell followed suit. He had never seen Chekhov freak out like this. Moments later, he was following him out the door into the angry orange clouds of sand, but Chekhov had stopped short, just a few feet away from the cargo carrier. Terrell almost ran into him, but before he could think of some cutting remark, he saw what Chekhov was looking at. They were surrounded by a group of people, shrouded as much by their messed up ragged clothes as by the blowing sands, blowing like the winds of violent death. Up on the ship, a guy shouted into the comm, "Starship Reliant to Captain Terrell, this is Commander Kyle. Will you please respond, Captain?" Kyle Wimplington waited a few moments, fighting back tears. They had been gone too long, at least that's how he felt. He frequently overreacted like this. He was way too fixated on Terrell, who was a source of constant worry for him. Where was he? What was he doing? Does he like me? Terrell was well aware of this infatuation and used it to his advantage, asking Kyle to get him stuff or clean up the captain's quarters. Sometimes he'd tell Kyle to wait outside the ready room because he had something he wanted him to do. Then later, he'd pretend to have forgotten all about it. "Oh, right, Kyle," he'd say after finding him standing at attention just outside the door. "Sorry, I totally forgot about you. Mark took care of that for me. Mark is such a great guy. He might be my favorite." "Captain Terrell, respond, please!" Kyle, quaking with panic, looked up at Lieutenant Commander Fang Jamrocket, who was standing behind him. "Let's give them a little more time," was the cold reply from Fang. Kyle was always like this. Fang should have gotten used to it by now, but really it just got more and more annoying. Sometimes he felt like he was the only person on the ship who actually did his job. Kyle just spent his days crying like a baby. Mason Dearthmorter and Strike Bossmaster were both the captain's perfect little pets. They didn't have to do shit if they didn't want to, which was always. Then there was Chekov. All he ever did was talk about his old Captain James Kirk and how he was so much cooler than Captain Terrell. Probably true, but still. Then there was the Starship Enterprise. Forget it. It was faster, bigger, and more badass than the Reliant. "If the Enterprise is so great, then why don't you just go back?" Fang said to him once. "Oh, right. They didn't want you. So why don't you go peel your ass off Terrell's ass and get Stryker to fix that tricorder that you broke?" Back on the surface, Chekov and Terrell had been rudely marched into the cargo carrier by those mysterious space hobos. Chekov took another moment to marvel at the quality of the carrier's construction. To actually see a Starfleet cargo carrier up close is to know that even the fearsome Skoskis Kogoskian Agelnigang, with its infinite subdimensional dick bundles, couldn't power thrust any part of its inverted poo dangles through those vacuum-sealed, triple-reinforced walls. It turned out that the leader of this ragged crew of people was Khan. Yep, the same guy I was talking about before. He was older, but still the biggest hunk in the room. Long silver hair cascaded down over his shoulders, partially covering up the blue tie-dyed scarf that would have looked dumb on anyone else. Not on him. Not when it had to get out of the way of his bulging chest and unnecessarily firm slab of pure muscle. Chekov had already met Khan and knew what to expect, but even he had to stifle an admiring whistle. Khan walked up to Terrell. "I don't know you." Then, turning to Chekov, "but you, I never forget a face." Was it possible? Did Khan remember him? Nobody had ever remembered him before. His teachers back in Starfleet Academy would ask him daily if he was in the right class. His own mom nearly tried to give birth twice, forgetting that he had already come out. Chekov had gotten in the habit of working his own name into conversation just to save himself the embarrassment of being forgotten. He even adopted a silly accent in a vain attempt to give himself a single distinguishing quality. It didn't work, and now he felt he had to keep doing it. What he didn't realize was that the Universal Translator was giving everyone the same silly Italian accent. The Universal Translator was super racist. "Mr. Chekov, isn't it?" continued Khan. Chekov nearly fainted with delight. Maybe he did faint. It's not like anyone would have cared. Recovering from his fugue state of intense, blistering joy, Chekov found that Khan was already in the middle of telling Terrell who he was and why he was here. It was a long story, but the gist of it was that 20 years ago, he and the crew of the SS Botany Bay had been stranded on this planet. They were all a bunch of superhumanly strong and smart people, genetically bred back in 1996 to be better looking and more fun than you. Too awesome to live, too sweet to die, they had been frozen in cryogenic sleep and sent off into space to make somebody else look bad. Some 200 years later, Chekov's previous ship, the Enterprise, came across them. Captain Kirk, not knowing any better, defrosted them. Oh God, Kirk and Khan. Let's just say they deserved each other. They got into some shit, but Kirk won the day, leaving Khan and his crew behind on SETI Alpha 5. Some people, Chekov, thought this was a dick move. "What?" said Kirk at the time. What did I do wrong? I was doing them a favor. SETI Alpha 5 is a great planet. Nice weather, decent natural resources. I was thinking of stranding myself there. Which was more or less true. Chekhov was feeling left out of the conversation and a bit insulted. When he finally managed to get a word in edgewise, he couldn't help lashing out a bit. So what are you doing on this planet? SETI Alpha 6 sucks! On SETI Alpha 5, there was a life! Why did you come here? There's nothing to do. No wonder you became such assholes! This is SETI Alpha 5. Khan was uncharacteristically losing his cool. SETI Alpha 6 was a completely different planet. 6 months after Kirk left us here, it conveniently blew up and knocked SETI Alpha 5 into a different, worse orbit. So while this used to be a nice planet with water and trees, it turned into a sandy disaster. Okay, that legitimately sucked, but it was too late to back down. Chekhov grasped for a different straw. Captain Kirk was your host. You repaid his hospitality by trying to steal his ship and murder him. Khan, realizing that they were just talking past each other, decided to steer things in another direction. He had come up with a great idea and was enjoying the feeling. Turning back to Terrell, he said, Allow me to introduce you to SETI Alpha 5's only remaining indigenous life form. He walked over to the clear plastic tank, produced a pair of tongs, and started feeling around for whatever was in there. Bingo! A hissing creature about the size of a potato lunged out of the dirt, directly into the waiting metal prongs. It was an earwig sort of thing, covered with armored plates that ran head to tail like an armadillo. What do you think? Said Khan. It killed 20 of my people, including my beloved wife. Khan stopped there. That was the ultimate conversation killer, which was exactly the point. A second pair of tongs came out, and Khan proceeded to do the grossest possible thing and poked the prongs down between two of the plates, emerging first with one writhing, gooey little slug, then another. He placed them in a small metal bowl and carried them over to give Chekhov and Terrell a better look. Not all at once, he continued, and not instantly, to be sure. You see, their young enter through the ears and wrap themselves around the cerebral cortex. This has the effect of rendering the victim extremely susceptible to suggestion. Later, as they grow, there follows madness and death. Khan, listen to me! Chekhov tried to sound as authoritative as possible, but all that Khan heard was, Mamma mia, shut up, you meatball of face, and listen to what this meatball got to say! Khan ignored the interruption. These are pets, of course, not quite domesticated. Captain Kirk was only doing his duty, Chekhov said with instant regret. It was a lame thing to say. Khan walked over and dropped the two little slugs into Chekhov and Terrell's empty helmets, which his men then put back on their heads. The slugs oozed onto their faces, then wiggled into their ears. The two grown men screamed and rolled around on the ground before realizing it actually wasn't so bad and settled down. That's better. Now, tell me why you are here, and tell me where I may find James Kirk.
Ah, music to my ears. Well, or in this case, it's words to my ears. And that's all the words we have time for today. Join us next time when we'll have chapters by Mystery Science Theater 3000's Mary Jo Peel and Robot Chicken's Kevin Shinnick. Until then, Kevin, land this spaceship.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks to this week's guest contributors, David Goodman, Felicia Day, Andrew Lynn, Andy Daly, and Arthur Meyer. Links to their fabulous book, swag, and cameo accounts can all be found on thenovelizers.com. The Novelizer was created by Stephen Levinson, produced by Stephen, Chris Karwowski, and Rob Kuttner, and edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Karwowski. Music by Cole Emoff, Andrew Lynn, Mike Wilson, and Chris Messick. Special thanks to Sarah Mabe, Crystal Dennis, Dennis DiClaudio, and Hannah Levinson. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram and Twitter at The Novelizers or visit thenovelizers.com. The Novelizers is a work of parody unauthorized by Paramount, Roddenberry Entertainment, or Star Trek. I'm Andy's intern, Kevin Carter. Thanks for joining.
Novelizers out.